Welcome to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. I'm here with my good friend Noel. Hi, Noel.
Hi, I'm looking forward to this recording.
Like what you did
there. What I did there. Yeah.
For those that are listening for the first time to the podcast, we've been shining a light on those bands that perhaps didn't get the profile we felt they deserved back in the 80s. And today we have, if you haven't guessed it, we have got a band called The Chords. So, Noel, I know you're familiar with that band.
I am. I saw them a couple of times back in the day near Northampton. There was a venue in a village, actually, called Harpole. The venue was called the Paddocks. And for a period of time, they used to have a few bands on there. And I saw the Chords there. But they had quite a few bands on there over the time. I saw the Dead Kennedys there as well, actually, would you believe? There's, you know, a few bands went through there. But yeah, I saw them. And I also saw them supporting the Jam, actually, at the Rainbow Theatre in London. And there were, I think, there were three support acts there. And one of them was the Nips, which, of course, was Shane McGowan, his band as well. So, and the Chords are on the same bill. So, yeah, I saw them back in the day.
Ah, brilliant. Okay. And, of course, today we're also going to be speaking to Chris Pope from the Chords. So that's coming up. Let's do a little bit of background about the band. So the Chords were sort of formed in 78, but they didn't play their first gig till 79. The members of the band were Billy Hassett on vocals, Chris Pope, who's guitar and main songwriter, Martin Mason, bass guitar. They eventually got a drummer, Brett Buddy Ascott, who was sort of in that Keith Moon style. And when you hear some of the songs, you can absolutely feel that coming through. And the story starts with Billy Hassett and Martin Mason, who were cousins.
That's right, yeah.
Who sort of rehearsed, they sort of did Beatles and Who songs while they were at school. So this band really started, you know, very, very early on.
I know that kind of 60s influence then, didn't they? That kind of 60s vibe going on from that time onwards.
So, yeah, so Chris Pope joined in 78. They obviously did a bit of rehearsing and so on. And then, strangely enough, they then tried to become the band in Quadrophenia, the movie.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Submitted a couple of demos there, Dream Dolls and a cover of The Who's song Naked Eye. They didn't quite get that role, but they had a debut performance in March 79 at the King's Head in Deptford, and they had this incredibly what I would consider to be meteoric rise.
Yeah, I mean, they got a lot of buzz around them immediately, didn't they?
Yeah, by the end of the month, they were literally playing to packed crowds played at the Wellington, and in the audience were like Polydor and NME and Paul Weller.
I mean, that's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
And that seemed to generate a massive amount of interest in the band, and it actually got them the support slot with the Jam. I don't know if that was the time you saw them or whether you saw them a bit later, but
no, I saw them in 79 as well. So May 79, actually.
They had this Radio One session for our good friend John Peel, who's
Oh, great
cropped up
stuff.
many
Yeah,
times
always. He's
on a
always the
podcast.
man who does this stuff to promote these bands, isn't he? It's
I'm
fantastic.
just in awe of the guy. It's
Yeah.
so impressive, the list of bands that he had on. That was in July 79, first session. Had three or four songs on that. Now it's gone. It's no use. Something's missing, and maybe tomorrow.
Sometimes I just
And then the sort of story takes a bit of an odd, I thought an odd turn. I don't know how you feel about it. Jimmy Percy
Oh yeah, Jimmy Percy.
Sham 69, apparently he had a label, JP Records, and he signs the band for that label, and they record some demos, and he does a bit of producing with them as well. They obviously got a support slot with the Undertones. And then for some reason, Jimmy Percy turned up with Steve Jones and Paul Cook of the Sex Pistols and decides to invade the stage. Once again, not quite sure of the whole story. It'd be interesting to hear what Chris says about it. But he invades the stage with these guys. And from that moment on, they sort of part their ways. It sounds like it was a pretty acrimonious time.
I mean, I'm guessing the Jimmy was kind of thinking of like, any press is good, you know. It's interesting, isn't it?
But after that, Polydor then took over, and then the band had their first single, Now It's Gone. And they'd sort of recorded that a couple of times, and they released it, got to number 63 in the charts, and then over the next year had a number of singles out that got in the sort of what I would call the lower reaches of the chart. Maybe
So,
Tomorrow was probably the
oh
one that
yes,
got to
that's
number
my favorite.
40.
Yes, I still play that a lot actually on the 7-inch. So yeah.
They got a lot of press, a lot of airplay, which interesting was what happened with the Cheetahs, wasn't it? They got a lot of
Yeah.
airplay, but no real chart success.
I mean, around that era, what I found was quite interesting was that the press was starting to label them as a mod revival band. Obviously, with the Jam being really big at that time, they were, and obviously Quadrophenia being, in the cinema and obviously being a kind of mod-related film, they were being sort of pigeonholed by the press of that. Now, what's interesting is obviously there were other bands around at the time who were also, in inverted commas, mod revival. There was the Merton Parkers, with Mick Talbot, who's obviously a fantastic keyboard player. And then obviously there was the Lambrettas, who did a cover version of Poison Ivy. And then of course there was the Purple Hearts, who were pretty good, but the Chords stood out because they had the tunes, they had everything that sort of went with it. But they actually tried to distance themselves from that label as a mod band. Which is sort of interesting, really. I mean, because they, they've got the 60s look, they've got the 60s vibe. And if you look at some of the pictures of them, like Billy Hassett on the album, it's actually wearing jam shoes, so there's a real connection there, but they decided they'd rather distance themselves from that. So it'd be interesting to find out about that as well.
I thought they were almost, other than maybe Secret Affair, I suppose you would say
Yes,
at the
yeah.
time, I thought they were almost like the de facto sort of leaders of that mod revival.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, it could be that they felt that they weren't happy about the idea that people might try and pigeon them as kind of jam impersonators almost, do you know what I mean? Because they had their own stuff, which had a bit of jamminess about it sometimes. But yeah, I can hear elements of loads of other bands in there, The Clash even. I can hear different stuff in there. So I think that maybe that might be one of the drivers to it,
Okay, so maybe tomorrow got to number 40, and more importantly, got them to their first Top of the Pops appearance.
Fantastic.
So we must have been great for them,
Yes.
because literally they'd only just formed literally about a year before. So to
Yeah.
get to that point is impressive. And then over the next year or so, they have a number of singles out: Things We Said, Something's Missing, British Way of Life, In My Street. And then a second Peel session, so with Tumbling Down, Happy Families, and So Far Away, and obviously then the album, which actually was quite successful, got to number 30 in the charts. The album called So Far Away. They gave away a free 7-inch single with that album, which is, people don't seem to do that anymore. Things
Very
We Said,
true.
and Now It's Gone.
I understand that around that period, at the end of 1980, they parted ways with Billy Hassett as the singer. They did a gig at the Music Machine in London. At some point after that, he left the band.
Yeah, once again, the story has a little bit of a strange turn, and they got in the guy who had been with the Vibrators, Kip Herring.
So they recorded a load more stuff with Kip, didn't they? That's when the One More Minute single came out. Yeah, it sounds like by September they pretty much decided to wind it up. I think they issued one last single, didn't
They
they, with that band?
did turn away again.
But again, nothing happened with that one, unfortunately, for them. So I think that's probably the nail in the coffin, really, I guess, for where they were at that point in time.
Okay, they did actually have a reunion
Right.
in 2010, and they did release a single, Another Thing Coming.
I used to dream, and dream my dreams would come true. I used to win, and know what I'd ever lose. But then the sun disappeared from my skies. I have begun to realize. Oh yeah. They said, boy, hey boy, if you think that's life, you've got another thing coming to you. Hey girl, if you think you're right, you've got a whole lot of learning to do.
But that didn't seem to last. And then basically, so Chris has created the Chords UK and goes out now under that particular name, and has made three albums: Take On Life, Nowhere Land, and Big City Dreams from 2021. So still making new music. And I read somewhere some of the songs that he's used on those albums were songs that were left over from the sort of Chords time back in the day. Yeah.
You and I saw them. You saw the Chords UK, didn't we? Supporting the Vapors. I think it was 2018. I think
we did.
Before I moved to Spain.
We did. Yeah, the 229 Club. Yeah. But they did release back in 2019, interestingly enough, just after we saw them. They did release literally their entire catalogue in a box set called Recordings. And that basically, if you want to know anything about the Chords, there's two things I would recommend. That box set is one, but also there's a book called Remembering Chords, compiled by a guy called Ray Butler. And that is like the encyclopedia. There's nothing more to know.
The encyclopedia of the Chords. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the way I'd describe it. Right. Well, there's a little bit of a potted history of them. Let's now get on and talk to Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello there.
Can you just share us a little bit of your background before joining the Chords? I know you were really young. And then sort of explain a little bit about how you then met Billy and Martin and how that all sort of came about, if that's okay.
No problems. When I was about 13, 14, my brother bought a guitar and didn't want it. And I just picked it up and started playing, or trying to start to play. And at that time, early mid-70s, I used to go, I was lucky to live in London. And I went to lots and lots of concerts, pre-punk. And then from there, just fell in love with music, which I always have done, and started to play guitar a little bit and that and this and that. And started trying to join a band. And the first band I really did join was with Billy and Martin. That'd be in early 78. We weren't really called anything. We used to rehearse and do covers and then play in Billy's work for the electricity board or gas board. We used to rehearse every Saturday night up in the Sydenham gas board place and end up playing in the local pubs in Deptford, the only place that ever. We were our own little PA. We played covers and 60s and punk songs. And then midway through, I think, 78, I was reading Bob Dylan's book by Anthony Scaduto, I think it was. And Bob Dylan's band was called the Golden Chords. And unbeknown to me, there was a doo-wop band called the Chords. I thought I'd boot out the gold a bit and call ourselves the Chords. So that's how that came about.
So you, not long after you formed, pretty quickly, I understand it was, fairly quickly, you got the support slot with the Jam.
Well, that had been 79. We played through 78 and I just writing songs late 78 or autumn 78. We came out with things there. We done one gig in that year with the original Chord songs. And then January 79, put an advert in the paper and Brett Ascott joined us, Buddy Ascott. And we did one gig at the King's Head in Deptford and all hell broke loose. There was like 200 people there and Gary Bushell from Sounds and Adrian Fields from NME. Next thing you know, Paul Weller's at our third gig and we're playing at the Rainbow 4 weeks later, 2 weeks later.
That is incredible. That is incredible. I did see you at the Rainbow, actually, with the Jam. But incredible.
It was, I think, our fifth gig. I don't really know much about it, but I think we were, it could have, you know, been a year later. Things might be a lot different, but you can't, you know, change things like that, can you really?
No, it's really impressive all the same, though, isn't it? It's a great story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What were those early gigs like then? Because obviously, whether it was the Thomas or Beckett, what were they like? You're obviously building up your support.
Yeah, I mean, in 78, we were just playing, anywhere we wanted to, or anywhere we could do. And then in 79, and then we never envisioned that a mod revival thing at all. We were at the 60s music, in punk music. But by, I'd say, March, April 79, it's quite obvious there was something going on. And we just happened to be in the right place at the right time for it. So the first original gigs in Deptford, Wellington Waterloo, which we sort of invented, were insane. I mean, there'd be 200 or 300 people there. I mean, you go and play it with 10 people. Yeah. Three men and a dog in October, paying 300 people 3 months later. So it was, very nice indeed.
Is it right that you sort of tried to distance yourself a little bit from the tag of mod revival?
I just kind of saw us, as a power pop band, really, or a band was playing sort of punky moddy, whatever you want to put it across. I didn't see much difference between us and, say, the Undertones or the Vapors, something like that. I mean, I didn't know the Vapors at the time, but it was kind of like, I didn't see us be kind of stalwarts and what flag bearing, waving for the mod, fraternity. Not that, I grew up with Quadrophenia. The first band I ever saw was The Who. So I had that installed in my mind. I mean, but I don't think in terms of like total fashion, we were, not the smartest looking band in the world. Oh, I certainly wasn't anyway. The scruffiest mod in town, I was called. So, there you are.
Excellent.
Because that scene, there was obviously a lot of bands in that sort of 79, 80. Even though I suppose whether you liked it or not, you were part of that sort of scene. And was there like a closeness between the bands or not?
A secret friend, Purple Arts, were from Essex, and we were from South London. We got on well quite Purple Arts. You didn't really see much of Secret Affair, and the Lambrettas, the four big sort of bands, they were from the South Coast. Yeah, we got on well with the Purple Arts, and we saw each other, other bands. It was fine. It wasn't sort of like, everyone hates each other or everyone's jealous. It was just, it happened so fast, no one really knew what they were doing, what was happening to them anyway, So, yeah, it was a good little scene.
And who was guiding you in that through that period, or was there no one?
No, the Corps never had a manager. We had no game plan. We had nothing. But we signed adversely to Polydor. We signed to Jimmy Percy's label and we fell out with good old Jimmy James. And I do believe that we'd done a pill session and every record company in London wanted us. And Polydor saw the T&Cs of the Jimmy Percy contract, which was a subsidiary of Polydor, and picked us up. And we didn't have any A&R man at Polydor either. So we were signed to a label that no one actually signed us to, with no manager. So we were on a fight for your right there, straight when you're 17, 18, there and then. And we were on the label with the biggest band in Britain at the time. We were
The Jam,
meant to be closely associated with how we were as well. So put the three together, and then here you go.
Is that Jimmy Per that Jimmy Percy, JP Records or whatever it was called? That seemed to be quite chaotic. I don't know whether it was.
Well, I've done about the record label. I suppose at the time, he was trying to push his, as you were saying, totally into that kind of like wear your suit and your shoes and this and that. And I never felt comfortable in that. I think we were kind of like I said, more like Gen X and bands like that, where you kind of got a bit of the 60s, but you want to bring a bit of the punk into it. So it was that kind of push that way. And he famously turned up one of our gigs with the Undertones at Guildford Civic Hall with Paul, Steve Jones, and Paul Cook, the Pistols. I think they were a bit worse for wear. They jumped on stage when the Undertones were on, when they weren't invited, and all hell broke loose. So we kind of like cut our ties for that reason and a few other reasons with them. In terms of the label, I don't think it lasted that long. But I mean, he had good intentions. He was picking street bands up and trying to do something. So you can't knock him for that, but really.
Have you
Have
spoken?
you have you spoken to him
Yeah.
since? I was just saying, same question.
Have I spoken to Jimmy Percy?
Yeah, to Jimmy. Yeah, to James.
No, we don't sell Christmas cards anyway. That's basically no.
So you got onto Polydor, and then the sort of single Now It's Gone, that sort of got to a point where it sort of stalled, didn't it?
Now It's Gone was meant to be the first mod single. We recorded it with Percy actually on my 18th birthday, and that was going to come out late April, early May. And because of what happened with Percy, it got stalled, and so it came out 6 months later, reproduced or re-recorded. And when you re-recorded something that's so near what it was at the time level, you kind of lose something to me. And that's what I felt about Now It's Gone. We had to put it out. Well, we had to put something out, and that was going to be the first single. So that came out in September that year. You always say that a record is only good as how much it's been played. To a certain extent, without being too cynical about it, with record companies. So, But I think you got to about number 60 in the charts, and what, probably some 25,000-30,000, which is probably number one nowadays, isn't it? So there are. And we did a great tour, 30 dates tour. I remember we stayed in one hotel in somewhere called Garston or Garforth in Yorkshire, because we've done 7 days in a row in different towns in Yorkshire.
So when you did
Yeah.
stuff like, obviously you did Peel Session and then Top of the Pops, Record Mirror and all that kind of stuff, do you find it kind of changed you? Because you obviously was suddenly this massive kind of a load of attention on you. Did it
Yeah.
create a problem in a way, or was it a good thing?
I mean, I was very young. I just turned 18, and the band was a couple of years older. We hadn't really known each other that well. I mean, Brett joined in the January, March. I'd known him 6 months. I'd known Billy. I was at school when I knew him of that period. So,
Oh wow!
yes.
So you were still at school when you played at the Rainbow.
I was still
Wow.
young, and the calls blew up, in a way in March 79. So I tried to do a double life at the time, which didn't really work, obviously.
No, you
So
couldn't help
it,
concentrate on school too much, could
well, I
it?
got really be playing in Leeds. You met me back home and doing some, being at 9:30 at school the next day. It was a bit weird.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was quite a lot of pressure on us to come up with the singles, be commercially as viable with the record company. So yeah, you've gone from being playing in a pub, having a bit of a laugh, to being like it's 24/7 and it's your job.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've talked to a lot of bands and they've all got a very similar story that the record company just pressure them all the time, and it's not commercial enough. It's not this, it's not that. And it's that I don't know if you experienced it, but some of them felt like TV21 recently. We talked to them and they were like, well, they wanted to kind of change our sound, and a few of the bands have said that as well, to manipulate it away from what the band's core was.
I think that you couldn't change our sound. It was what it was. I think with well, going on my second album, which would have been the second album, second single, we went back and treaded back and listened to a lot of stuff that was going on at the time, like Joy Division, U2, and Teardrops, and Wah, especially. So that was that. But I think by then the record company kind of like they make their own minds up with what's coming in and what's going on. And in 1980, 81, I suppose you will remember, there's an incredible amount of different type of music and genres going on. You had ska, mod, you still had punk, then you had rockabilly, and the New Romantics were coming in as well. So you're like, bang, all these things coming together.
Yeah,
So
yeah, yeah.
record companies standing go, oh, this is what we want this week,
You seem to be the main songwriter for the band. You must have felt maybe a bit of pressure on that to come up with those songs in such a short period of time, or were they already
Well, it's
there?
kind of given away. I mean, nowadays, even with big bands, they don't have record companies, so they can do what they want when they want. It's a bit old school, which is good. It's going like, oh, you've got 3 singles a year and an album, and you've got to come up with them. And they say, right, you're going to record a single on the 28th of March, so you've got to have the song written by 28th of February, which is, it's pressure in a way, but sometimes you need to kick up the arse. Most musicians do, otherwise they'll sit down and spend hours just farting around with it. You've got to come up with the goods, but sometimes it works, sometimes it worked for us, and like with the British Way of Life. Then the next thing in my street, it didn't work for us, in my opinion. So, 6 of 1 is always as the way, really.
Because that single got impacted a bit by the strike, didn't it? The Top of the Pops strike.
British Way of Life, apparently, we went within Top of the Pops, and I think, as far as I remember, you get the phone call saying, well, you were going to be on it, but the guys, the cameramen, are having a strike this week. And as records are in them days, if you didn't go up another four or five, six places in the top 75, you stop getting airplay and off you go. I sound like I'm talking too much about the other side of music, but it's it kind of entwines when you basically half run your band as well and manage it. So it's kind of a bit weird for us.
Yeah, I don't think you can disconnect the two really. I think
No.
that we spoke to the Photos and they had the same issue in the same time. I think they had their progress was completely halted by the Top of the Pop strike.
Yeah, they actually played with us at the Electric Ballroom
They
on
did. It was
yeah.
fascinating that it had such an impact. There wasn't much on. It was the Old Grey Whistle Test or Top of the Pops.
No, yeah. I think like 20 million people watch it on a Thursday night, which is
Yeah,
crazy.
incredible.
Yeah, it's
Incredible.
massive.
But I've got to ask, Cheggers plays pop, Chris?
Yeah, come on.
Come on, spill the beans. What was that like?
We went to Manchester in Oxford Road, so it was nice. You stand on podiums, and all the kids are just jumping around. And yeah, why not? It was a bit of fun. And we all dressed up with our punk gear on just to annoy a few people. So there you go.
But to even get that gig must have been
It's great, isn't it?
just.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the song was about top 50 or in the chart around that. So obviously, the BBC go, what's happening this week? Well, and off we went.
And then you get to a stage where you start you get the start creating the first album So Far Away.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that, because this has stood the test of time in our view.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much.
Still it still holds up today. Can you just talk us through
That
that
was
process?
recently the live set from 1979 into we recorded it early January, February 1980. I think I recorded it in 2 weeks over a period of time, and it was basically the set we were doing, all the songs we had, plus a couple of covers from the period before. So it was quite easy to do, as opposed to this is always the adage in it, like you do your first album, you've been writing it for 10 years or whatever, and you go and play it with probably 10 months of art in our case. So it was I don't recall having any difficulties with it apart from Hold It, I'm Coming, I think, when I was singing, which I'd rather not sing it anymore. But I mean, it was we used to do it live. Put it this way, I've re-released it, I wouldn't put that on it.
That's still a good song, though. But I know
Yeah,
what you're saying.
done by Isaac Hayes, whoever singing, Sam and Dave, yeah. Not by Chris Pope singing, though. Anyway.
It must be due for a re-release, I'd have thought, or remastering or something.
I think it's come out in different guises on different labels, mod labels, but I don't think Polydor have actually sat down and done anything with it. It's 45 years next month.
And is there
Yes.
anything left in the vaults? Because I know that with your Chris Pope and the Chords UK, you've in some of the earlier albums, you'd sort of gone back and picked out some of those maybe unfinished songs and finished those. Is there anything left?
There's a couple that never saw the light of day, that mainly from the period after Billy left, but from the So Far Away stuff, probably not. We were due to do a second album a year later or 18 months later, so I've sparsely put two tracks, maybe three or whatever, on the three different Chords UK albums and some Pope albums. And so there was an album that came out called This Is What They Want on Universal back in 2000. That had a lot of stuff that would have been on the second album.
So on the first album, Dennis Munday was involved, I think. Obviously involved with the
Yeah.
Jam as well. How do you get on with him?
He was actually the only person probably would talk to us. And I'm not
Oh,
joking. I'm
wow.
actually not joking. He wasn't an A&R man. I think it was a production, whatever his title was. He was the only one we could actually go and talk to and get anything, sort of done with Polydor. Because
Wow.
like I said, we didn't have an A&R man we could go to, and we didn't have a manager. So he was our port of call, really. Anyway, he was a lot of time for Dennis. He was got a great bloke.
Oh, brilliant. Great to hear.
So you mentioned about Billy leaving, and I don't know if it's still a
No, it's fine.
is okay to talk, yeah? Okay, cool. Because when he left, obviously the One More Minute single, I think it was, didn't quite make it. I wondered if you'd sort of felt quite disillusioned by that, or was it just one of those
I
things that it
think
was a
there are periods in your time over the last 30, 40 years, there's a mark where you go, right, that hurt, and that hurt, and that hurt, and One More
right.
Minute was one of them. And looking back, people, Brett and Martin, were saying, like, people say, well, I should sing it. And I was like, oh, I don't know. And maybe I tried and thought, maybe not. And who needs another three-piece band on Polydor at the time? It all sort of allow, different sort of things. And so we brought Kip in, and it took a bit longer to get it out. And we were trying to move in a different direction, just not even different directions. You kind of just want to create and do something different and move on and try different sounds. Like I said, by the time that came out, I thought by May 81, even the other lot of the other the Secret Fairy weren't charting anymore. All the Lambrettas and Purple Hearts had
Right.
come and gone, I think. So suddenly, Stray Cats in the charts and Duran Duran were. And we were 19 and 20, and we were old hat. So
Incredible.
you put that with it. But I mean, I still stand by the track one, and I still play it live. In the end, it's about the song, isn't it? What goes round, you're out of control with, you have no control of it. But so yes, it was one of those moments that was that I felt a little cry in my heart.
So did you feel, obviously you said you brought Kip in, was there any thought of like just sort of, I know it was sort of the beginning of the end, but was there anything about sort of just stopping and saying, look, this is, we started as school kids, we've had success, let's finish.
Well, we actually were the first band out of all the biggest bands that said, no, this I've had enough of this. I want to move on and do something new, and I don't want to be, dragging myself around playing these songs. I want to do it sort of wish bit now, but playing those songs that I don't need. So I wanted a complete break. And after Sail Away Again, I think we got offered like an indie deal with a label to do a couple of singles, but I didn't think people were listening to us as a band. They were listening to us as a mod band, and people gave me perceptions about that. And I just thought, now I'd rather just be known as a musician and move on,
So
That's the
what did you
thing.
do? What did you do? Because there was a gap, wasn't there, between you beginning, becoming Chris Pope and the Chords UK. So what
Well, me
was?
and Brett formed Agent Orange with Grant, who had been in the mod scene, a guy called Kevin Peters, who was in the kind of like 60s Stones, Yardbirds stuff. And we got a huge big deal with Virgin 10, which another one that kind of like it went down right at the last minute. So we've done a lot of demos for that, but never released anything. And then from there, with Kevin, I went to America in a band called Gatecrash Heaven, and we got a management deal with Diana Ross's husband, who was Bob Ellis, who he was big up on MCA Records. He signed Graham Master and a lot of the early Raps guys. So I was out there for 18 months, and that took me to the end of the 80s. And then the 90s, I had children, and then I started making music again in the 20s or the noughties to get it all the way along.
Well, what was the event? So you said before that you'd had a couple of events, obviously the Billy leaving and was one of them. Was there any others that you can point to in your career so far that you think,
How long
yeah, well, I don't want this to become like a self-help you
have
session, but
you got?
I'm beyond that now, mate. No, there are markers in it when you go, right, I think there's a song here, there's a track here that might, elevate you or might get a lot of attention. And that when that doesn't get, nowadays, probably about 20 years, but it doesn't get played on Six Music or it doesn't get played this and that. And then and they go, oh, you go, that's disappointing to you. And yet the next single or the next track, you're not that bothered about. So it's kind of like there was a track called Mutiny on the Thames, which was on an album called Peace of Mind, which came out and it's still, we still play it live. There'll always be an angle on that you can't depend. But watch out, fools who make the rules. For the Mutiny on the Thames. Bullet points in your life, you go, maybe that would have taken off. I was in America in 89, and we were very close to, getting a deal with an American label, and then things come around and don't work out, and suddenly you're back in London a week later when you was in Los Angeles sitting by a swimming pool. Now I'm driving a van the next day, and then bang, like it's kind of like it hits you. So without getting too into my personal life, but there are bullet points in life where it could have gone either way.
See, when you must have got some pride though when Mojo magazine selected Maybe Tomorrow for their Modern Britain compilation in 2020, 2005.
Yeah, that was nice. I mean, Maybe Tomorrow's got me around the world. I mean, without being, let's go to the positive side of it. Now, since 2010, been to Australia, Japan, America twice. All over the UK, mainly with the Chords UK. And I know we play 60, 40, old, new, or vice versa sometimes. But, we sold out four nights in Madrid in the last 18 months.
Wow.
And when Maybe Tomorrow comes on, they go nuts. They're not like, it's like, this is a song. I just, it's completely, it's their tune. And, you find that all over the world. So, yes, it's Mojo. Mojo's a good magazine. So it was very nice to be on in good company in there as well.
Congratulations.
I mean, it is a mega song. I mean, you know.
Thank you very much.
Well, we
I'm
spoke
actually doing a weird version. I've got an album called But Then Again coming out next year, a double album of stuff I've done literally from 1978. And instead of trying to do Maybe Tomorrow Again, no. You're not going to create, you're not going to there's no point in putting the band and doing that. You can't beat the original. Some things you need to leave untouched. So I'm doing a sort of acoustic version of it, which is it sounded quite good. So it's nice to break it down and bring it back to where you started with it, you know?
Brilliant. Is that your style of writing? Did you always start with an acoustic guitar? Or
I've written two songs on piano badly, and the rest of them, just acoustic or you know, electric. I don't jam around with the bands. I never did that in the rehearsal room. Can't do that. To me, it's always about a melody and a vocal and a lyric. You know, it's got to do it that way. So old fashioned, I guess. Yeah.
So when you get for the Chords UK stuff, then do you get to the studio where with pretty much fully formed demos, or does it evolve when you're in that?
Well, nowadays I'll go to rehearsal room on my own or sit in here with my flat with an iPhone, maybe use a drum machine, and I'll play the song with the verse chord, whatever arrangement is, and then go into a rehearsal room with the drummer. If the bass player's around, they'll go and do that. So the time we got in the studio, the drummer knows the arrangement. I can go in there and play it. And as well, you know, these days with Pro Tools and stuff like that, you can do what you want. You go, I don't want that verse there with this and that. So you've got to, you know, move around. But that's how we do it. And Ken, the drummer in the Chords UK, is very versatile and very quick. So you can knock out 3 backing tracks in 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours.
Wow.
So that's how we do it.
Do you still keep in touch with any of the original members?
I'm in touch with Billy a bit online. I don't really talk much to Brett and Martin anymore. So. That's that one with him. But Billy's cool. Billy lives in Japan now. He's been there like 30 years. He's got a big life out there. It's good for him.
And if we had to ask you what your greatest memory was of your career so far, does it split into chunks? Or what would you say is your greatest memory?
Well, because it goes back so long ago, and I've got to remember, when you're 18 and everything's just happened for you, you don't appreciate it as much as you do when you're 40 or 50, when you've worked really hard for it. Because just happened, we were in the right place, right time, and so you know, you always wanted to be on Top of the Pops ever since you're 89 years old. So, doing Top of the Pops 2 or 3 times it's got to be, looking back, you can say, you know, that's very much a highlight in terms of songwriting. There's stuff I've written that I'm pleased with, and there have been a certain amount of gigs. We did 2 Pledge albums, I don't do Pledge anymore, I don't think, but I mean, the first 2 Chords UK albums, we did Pledges and we got all the money we wanted through to make the albums. And we did a big 100 Club gig for the album launch of that. And we do it each time. We're doing one more. And they're quite significant and nice moments in my life.
We spoke to Fisher Zed recently, and John Watts specifically. Yeah. He's got quite a big following in Germany and France and the Netherlands. Yeah. And significantly larger than, say, in the UK. And he was saying about the differences between the audiences, you know, in the UK and in Europe. Have you found, obviously, you've also got that sort of fairly global reach as well. Have you found that difference?
You find some parts of England can be quite restrained. I mean, London's always been, you know, you've got your own home following, but and they'll know it and understand and probably get the lyrics a bit more. But I've always found when we play in Europe, because we don't just play as much as we do in England, we're kind of up for it, and in southern Spain especially, and Germany, we get a great response. Same in America, really, when we played to play in San Francisco. To be honest, the Chords weren't a really big band. The original band never got out to America. So for taking my band out there and playing to 300 people in a club in San Francisco on a Saturday night, come on, you know. it doesn't get any better, really, for something like, you know, for that. It really doesn't. So it's amazing. So, you know, you've got to... Yeah, these are the ups as opposed to the ones we were talking about, the misses. This is the hits, you know.
And just one last one for me is, when we've spoken to other bands, the John Peel sessions have become, you know, something that's a real moment for them. They feel like they've really achieved it. How was it for you? Was it the same feeling or was it different?
Absolutely legendary. John Waters, I think it was Waters, came. He's there. He was his producer. Marquis said, went to Peel, so you've got to have this band on your shows, okay. So we went to Maida Vale and recorded 4 songs. We've been playing a lot, so we were quite tight and didn't think anything of it. And then we find out that it's going to be, we didn't have a record deal at the time. we'd gone between Jimmy Pursley and Paul Poddy. So it came out in July, I think, June, July. And you think, oh, well, he's going to play at the Man United and along with Geraghty Colin the same week. You know, it's going to be like that, you know, whatever. It's going to be like that. And he played 4 weeks in a row and was just banging on about it. Like, he loved it. And through that, that's where all the record companies came to us. So it was a very special moment. And, you know, to find someone like John Peel liking it was amazing because he, above and beyond, I can't think of any other DJ over the last 60 years who's been so important to people in music as John. I mean, I used to listen to his stuff religiously. I mean, at 10 o'clock tonight, you're not going to catch me listening to the Radio One. I mean,
No.
makes the age, whatever it is. But I just think because he would, you discover things, wouldn't you? You know, as opposed
Yeah.
to like, oh, I'm going to listen to my favorite show, but then you'd play something and you go, I've never, you know, band from Finland on an indie label or something like that. It's very open, and that's what I liked about his take on music.
So, Chris, this is the what I would consider to be the Bible
Okay.
of the chords. The Remembering the Chords book by compiled by a guy called Ray Butler.
Hello,
So,
Ray. He's a top man, is Ray.
yeah.
He's been, I think he's doing a design for my final album next year. So
Oh,
well
brilliant.
done, Ray. Well done, Raymondo.
What isn't in here that you'd like to share?
What's not in there? Oh, I couldn't say. I think it's mainly about the people talking about us as opposed to us talking about us, which is great. That's what I like about it because there's nothing worse than a band banging on about themselves. So I think it covers all territories of the chords. Maybe I could talk a bit more about the songs, but no, I think that's best left to me in my head.
Okay, brilliant. Well, look, I mean, thank you so much for sharing what you've shared. Your story is fascinating, and the fact that you're still making great songs, you're still making great music, that sound that you've had is still with you, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, guys, for having us on and good luck with your shows. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. See
Thank
you
you.
again.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. See
Ta-da.
you. Ciao. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources, but of course, if you want to add any more details to what we've talked about, then you can of course contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.com.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, the Uncharted 80s. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.